All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I don't know how many people are new anymore. Are there new people? Welcome. If you're new, just sit over there and you'll get the hang of it. All right, I'm going to talk to some of these other people that have been here for a while. And then I'll talk to maybe someone, a celebrity of some sort. Maybe today it might even be Matthew McConaughey. I'll be talking to Matthew McConaughey in a few minutes, but now just hang out if you're new here, and let me talk to some of the people that have been here for a while. All right, I'm not trying to exclude you. I just want you to get the hang of what's going on. So what's going on with that thing? Did you get it fixed? What's going on with your kid's arm? What's going on with your kid's foot? What's going on with your kid's rash? What's going on with your kid's hair? Who did that? Was that on purpose? How are you holding up, though? Seriously, did you get that thing done? How's working from home? Did you stop masturbating during meetings? Because I think you should. I think that you the vigilance necessary to get away with that, it seems challenging to some people. So, and also we have to make the adjustment. It's just time to make that adjustment. All right. The one thing that this pandemic has showed us is that a lot of us, if you're fortunate. Now, look, I've been working from home a long time, at least this part of my life that you're hearing, I've been doing from my house for a long time. And back in the day, pre-plague, I would require people to come over. I would require the engagement to be live and in person. But you can't require that much. Every once in a while now, I can make a pretty safe situation out here. I've got a plexiglass divider. I've got hand sanitizer. I've got masks. But I've done a few people, mostly comics and Wayne Coyne, live. But it's a lot to ask somebody, and I understand that, and it's slightly dangerous. But I guess my point is, what some of us have grown to realize is that you really can, if your job allows you, work from home and work from home in a fairly efficient way. And I think people have adjusted to people working from home to such a degree that our major talk shows on television are now just kind of guys sitting on their couch. Now, the vulnerability of that is a bit much for me. We can definitely see it's all the sort of machinations of show business have now been laid bare. And you can really see who's got the juice and who doesn't, who requires more artifice than the next guy. But I guess we're seeing that everybody's human. Now, I don't want to get away from the point here. The point is, making the adjustment to knowing that your workplace is now your home means pants. It means no dicks. It means, you know, make sure at the very least that, you know, if you're trying to protect your privacy, you've engaged that properly. You know, I think that we've seen the fall of a fairly public person because the adjustment hadn't been fully made yet. That you are working from home, even if it's the same chair that you jerk off in when your family's away or during that special work time, that's not really work time, that when you're working, you're working. And the repercussions of mixing work and whatever else you do in that chair can be disastrous. That's a public service announcement. Now, before I forget, I fairly frequently right now I'm going on Instagram Live in the mornings. And I have coffee. I do about an hour of riffing and thinking and answering questions, thinking out loud. I do a lot of what I used to do on a stand-up stage. I engage in the moment and I kind of riff. It doesn't cost anything, but I'm doing a new hour every few days, that's for sure. But I'm on Instagram Live a lot, and I seem to have gotten this hook going where I kind of move my face into the camera. I say, use whatever options you have at your disposal to maintain your sanity without hurting yourself or other people. And then I say, too close? Am I too close? You can come and watch and enjoy. I also usually post them so you can enjoy them later in the day. But the bottom line is, we're going to have a t-shirt. There's a t-shirt. We got the Marin Too Close t-shirt. It was inspired by a photograph by a guy named Steve Rose, who grabbed a bunch of shots from the live stream and put them together in a grid. And then a fan named Cat Rhodes put them on a shirt and was like, wow, that's a good design. So let's tweak it a little bit. and we tweaked it a little bit, and you can get them now at podswag.com/WTF or click on the merch tab at WTFpod.com for the Too Close t-shirt. It's a good one. You know, it's official WTF merchandise, but it's kind of a spin-off because it's the IG Live tag. Too Close? Can't really do that with audio. But if you want to see what I'm doing over there, come on. Come on over. Come over. What are you going to do? What are you doing? I can bring it over. Come on over to Instagram Live. Come on. What are you? Come over here. What are you doing? You know, Mike Binder, the comedian who I used to watch when I was a kid, was on this show. And I don't know if you remember when he was on this show, but he's part of the Comedy Store history. He was always sort of a presence in all the stories about the old Comedy Store in the 70s, so I wanted to have him on. But when I had him on, he didn't want to talk about the Comedy Store, and he had closed the door to that part of his past. And I kept pushing him into it. And then now he's like full in, born-again Comedy Store guy, fully embracing the past, and made a doc about it with the support of Peter Shore producing, and Paulie's in it. But it's a fully sanctioned Comedy Store doc. It's on Showtime. They've showed 3 episodes. I think there might be 6. But this last episode, episode 3, it was a lot about Kennison. You know, I had some experience with Kennison, some dark, weird, druggy experiences with Kennison. And I tell the story that you all know. But I'll tell you, there's a beautiful moment in there where Kennison's old best friend, they after he died, they definitely were not best friends. Carl LeBeau has been on this show and talked about the fact that posthumously Carl learned that his wife gave birth to Sam's baby, his best friend's baby. Sordid, maybe. But Carl's has found peace with it, and Carl's also ill. Sadly, there's a GoFundMe for Carl if you want to help out. Carl has a terminal cancer, and he needs some equipment, and he's dealing with other stuff, back issues. But you can go to GoFundMe.com/F/Carl, Carl-LeBove, LaBove. Now, it's weird. I'll explain. I've had some emotions about this. Because that Comedy Store period for me, which didn't last long, which would blew my mind out on drugs, and I would say was a fairly traumatic time for me, in that I did lose myself in cocaine and lack of sleep and cocaine psychosis, and I had to leave in a very fucking compromised state. I ran away from Hollywood in the late 80s, hearing voices in my head, being chased by things I only understood, though QAnon seems to understand them now. Fortunately, I was able to get rid of the hallucinations and the massive universal conspiracy that had my number, and now it seems to have manifested itself as a political tool for fascists. But I found out it wasn't true because it wore off. Took a year and a half. But anyway, so it was a traumatic time. I had a tremendous amount of resentment against Sam Kennison and against Carl. But over time, I sort of started to let some of that go and process it and whatever. And Sam died, of course. You know, I think me and Carl make up on the podcast I did with him. But the bottom line is, if you watch this 3rd episode of the Comedy Store doc and you watch Carl, there's bits and pieces of his stand-up, and then he tells the story of Sam dying in his arms, and it's truly profound and moving. But he was such a fucking unique comedian and such a great talent and such a present fucking dude in terms of how he acted things out and personified things, and the space he created on stage was truly unique. And it was weird because, you know, out of nowhere, I get this email from Dan Pasternak, who's a guy who's been involved with comedy for many years as in development, but also was a comic early on and spent some time at the Comedy Store. And I get this email from Pasternak about the GoFundMe and about the tragic situation that Carl's in terms of his health. And on the link, there's a comedy bit. And I watched it, and it's a bit about being a designated driver. And just watching Carl do the work, it was moving to me. I laughed, and I thought about like what that guy, what I went through with these fucking guys back in the day, what, how they hurt me, but then how we made up. But I just realized how exciting it was to be around funny people, and how funny he fucking was, and how much laughter I got out of that guy. He was so fucking funny. He still is, and he's sick. And you know, I pitched in. But it was out of gratitude. You know, after all that, after all the darkness and all the weirdness and all the resentment and all the judgment and all the trauma, what really transcended, even watching this special about that time in my life, was how fucking fun it was and how much laughter I got out of these fucking people. I mean, the one thing about being a comic and coming up in it and spending your whole fucking life in it is you're around the funniest fucking people that ever lived. If you lock into, and it's different for everybody, but everyone's got their crew. And I've been through a few crews, and I've had the honor of spending a lot of time with some of the funniest people that ever lived throughout different points in my career. Some people you don't even know, some people you do. At the Comedy Store, before the Comedy Store, Boston, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, different lives. I've lived a lot of lives, and I've spent a lot of time with a lot of fucking hilarious people, and what a fucking gift. What a fucking gift to remember just how much you fucking laughed. I mean, I'm a comic. I'm an angry idiot. You know, I've been through my own shit, but one of the great fucking perks of working in this fucking racket is being around the funniest fucking people that ever lived and laughing your fucking ass off. I'm grateful for that. And I hope Carl is okay in terms of comfort in this time, but I hope that people can help out and make it as comfortable as possible for him, because he was a funny fucking guy, and he probably gave me a couple more years. That's all. So Matthew McConaughey is here, and this was interesting because I didn't know, you know, what it would be like to talk to him. He's awfully excited, and he seems excited all the time, almost to the point of like, is that even real? But he wrote this book called Green Lights, which is available wherever you get books. And I get books by my guests. I don't usually have the time to read them nor feel the need to. But some reason I started reading this, and I fucking read the whole book. I think I said to him at the beginning, I'm like, I think if anyone else had written this, I don't know if I would have finished it. But because I could picture you saying it, it all made sense to me. It's very excited. It's very positive, proactive, a little bullshitty, a little self-mythologizing, a little entertaining, a little moving. It's all in there. But, you know, there was a part of me when I'm talking to Matthew McConaughey where I'm like, is this guy for real? All right, all right, all right. Come on. What's going on in there? But this is me talking to Matthew McConaughey.
Hey,
Mark,
man.
Mark.
What's up, buddy?
A whole lot.
Oh, yeah? Yeah?
Oh, shit. Even if I didn't want it to be.
You're locked down with three kids and a wife and everything's going crazy?
And my 88-year-old mother.
Your mother's there too?
Damn right. We got the whole crew, man. We're bunkered in, man. Trying to protect a few susceptible lungs and outrun this old COVID bitch.
I got my Piggly Wiggly shirt on to honor Texas and New Mexico.
Yeah, baby. That's up in East Texas. We got those Piggly Wigglies, man. You move down to Central around Austin, you start getting HEBs. But yeah, Piggly Wigglies are going Bible Belt, barbecues and Baptist churches, parts of Texas.
Yeah, I grew up in Albuquerque, so there was a Piggly Wiggly or two there.
Albuquerque, man. We shot gold there.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of Albuquerque.
It's great.
I've never seen so many CVSs.
That's new to me. I mean, you grew up in Texas and I'm older than you, I think, but there was no CVSs when I was there, maybe a Walgreens or two.
Well, the Walgreens and the CVS is I was guessing my inside joke in my head was it was about Breaking Bad being around there. But Albuquerque reminds me of it was a sister city of what Austin, Texas was 25 years ago.
Right.
And also Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah.
Albuquerque, Tucson, Austin. It's like there's less curbs. You go down a road and just kind of pull off the side. It's just everything's a little bit more of a merge around Albuquerque.
Right. Yeah. And they were big. Those are college towns. Like I used to work at a place across from the college. I loved it. I was just out in Taos a few weeks ago trying to run away from something. It kind of worked for a week.
Let me ask you this, talking about running away from something or running to something. Do you know the Monastery of Christ in the Desert there in Abiquiu?
No, but I read about it in your book.
If you get there, dude, those are some radical dudes, man. Those are some righteous, radical dudes. I met that guy, Brother Christian, there. There's 13 different people. There's monks from 13 different countries there, and they're like the Oakland Raiders of monks. They didn't fit in at the very formal Benedictine monasteries, and so they were sort of outcasts, and they all go there because it's in the desert, and you're just surrounded by the Chama River and where George O'Keefe was doing her paintings and other nature's there. It's a beautiful spot, man.
Well, what's their deal? I mean, I'm a Jew, and as a wandering Jew, do I just go in and go like, help me out?
All you got to do is ring that bell, Mark. If you ring that bell, they find you a cot. I promise you. Wandering Jews, all welcome, sir. A Buddhist guy is a guy who gave me a room the second time I was there. I went, I showed up, there were no rooms, and this Buddhist guy gave me his room. He gave me his cot, and he slept on the floor. I mean, they welcome everyone.
Well, we can get to that because how you got there is sort of interesting. I ended up reading the whole book. I don't know how. I don't usually do that. But
I was going to ask you that.
What if I read it?
Well, yeah, if you really read it, I mean, it's a big ask.
No, I did read it.
Someone throws a book on me and says, "Hey, man, we read my book." I'm like going, "Damn, it better be good, man, because I got a lot of stuff to do."
I know. Well, I fortunately there is time now to do things.
Just a little bit.
So I was able, I just sort of locked in. The weird thing is like with the sort of philosophical bent and at the beginning, you say this isn't a self-help book, but you do have you have sort of constructed retroactively a functioning philosophy of life and sort of a hero's journey for yourself. And, I think if anyone else had done it, I would have been annoyed. But for some reason, because you're you. it's so in your voice. I'm like, man, this guy would be annoying if it wasn't Matthew McConaughey.
Well, let me ask you this. Would it have been annoying if I didn't step in shit so much myself?
No, I don't think it's annoying. Like, I think the humility of it is fine. And I think all of it's pretty good. But it's your passion, that comes through it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not being critical because I read the whole thing, and there's a couple of things that you wrote down, like your little post-its and shit. I enjoyed the book, but there was a couple where I was like, "Oh, come on, man, really?
Come on, give me one."
Well, here's one. Sometimes we have to leave what we know to find out what we know.
Yeah.
you're repeating it. Yeah, no, I get it. Right?
Absolutely.
But like, are these all things that you've written?
Yeah.
And you just like, but these are things you've written your whole life. What do you put them on post-its around your house? I have little notebooks everywhere too, but none of my post-its or notes to myself are proactive in any way. They're always grim and dark.
Well, you see, a lot of my early stuff was grim and dark and absolutely Looney Tunes. I was imploding on myself.
Yeah.
But the opening, you know, who, what, where, when, how, why? That's the greatest question. Well, wow, that's a great existential question as an 18-year-old.
Right.
You know, no one wants to watch that independent movie. So, you know, they started off just complete seeking without answers. And as it went on through life, I'm still interested in the same stuff I was interested in.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I've kind of made them a little more proactive and said, hey, okay, enough with the mental meditation, McConaughey. Let's get proactive and see if we can get some affirmation to move forward with some of this shit that is on your mind.
Right.
And so that one came to me just very simple, very simply. It's kind of like that one in Peru. All I want is what I can see, and what I can see is in front of me. Whoop, very simple.
Yeah.
But it came to me. That one came to me about Leave What You Know to Find What You Know in Australia. The year that I was thrown out.
Bad year.
How about that story? Did you get it? Was I going through some shit then?
No, I mean, it's just like one of those horrible things where you're young and you're sort of like, this sounds interesting. Being an exchange student in Australia, the biggest nightmare of being an exchange student is being with a family that's creepy or weird. And it was a lot. And I wasn't criticizing the book. I enjoyed the book, or I wouldn't have read the whole thing, because, you know, you kind of call yourself out on a lot of stuff. You do sort of set up at the beginning that, you know, you can be a bit of a bullshit artist. Like, a couple of things stood out to me. It's like, yeah, I understand you stole the wood in the middle of the night to build the treehouse, but you're going to tell me that treehouse was 13 stories high?
13 stories high.
Stop it. Come on.
Start it.
It was 13 stories high, Matthew.
Ponderosa, 13 stories.
You built a treehouse in the middle of the night over a series of months.
Over 3 months.
Swiss Family Robinson big, though. Nobody knew.
Exactly.
Nobody knew.
No, I was at, and like I said, I had that chamois tied around my waist.
Yeah.
And I had, the
Daisy electric, BB gun? The nail gun.
No. The nail guns. Yeah. You know those straps? Yeah. Poncho beads strapped over. No, I was, yeah. Now, was it 150 feet or however many? That might have been a tad of an impression, but it was 13 stories, and I would cut around, and it was a great tree to do it. It was 13 stories high when I was done.
And you never went back to see if it was still there?
No, but you know, you bring that up. I've had two people bring it up, going back, oh, you should go back, or someone should go back and see if there's relics of that in that tree out there, because I bet you it's been developed by now.
I mean, you went to Africa twice based on dreams. You can't go back to town. I know, based on the town in Texas to see if your childhood treehouse is still there.
I don't even know if I could find it, the area. I'd have to go back in my whole family and find out where was that double wide dad and I were living in at that time. I'm not even sure where it was.
That's the interesting thing about like some of this stuff. Like, it started out, the whole book opens with like a pretty, you know, aggressive scenario of domestic violence. And you kind of move from there. You know, you're like, you know,
I wanted to set the bar real quick to say, okay, we're not just completely joking around here, and we better have some thick skin.
Well, I know, but like, how much of that was there? I mean, how old were you when you were born in Texas or no?
Yeah, born in Texas, Uvalde, 1969.
So you've got one biological brother and one adopted brother?
Exactly. My oldest brother's 16 years older than me.
That's Mike?
That's Mike, a.k.a. Rooster. And Pat's in the middle, yeah.
And so you're born in Texas, and your dad, now, like, I just got to ask, like, because there's a process in the book where, you know, you're kind of putting yourself together, you challenge yourself, and you're kind of like, there's the type of self-awareness you have around becoming the person you want to be.
Right.
Sort of has to come from a place that, you know, where, you know, obviously, you know, you had the wherewithal to think about that. So you were conscious of that, which means that, you know, there must have been enough drama in the house with your parents and your dad. They must have been selfish enough to somehow leave you kind of longing for a sense of self.
Oh, well, that isn't the way I saw it. I mean, the way I saw it was, look, all those stories that on paper are, you know, that's why I call it beauties of brutality. That on paper, you go, oh, my gosh, call the CPS. McConaughey must have been in therapy for the rest of his life to get over that stuff he saw. No, that's not.
No, I get
the
that.
The love. Yeah. Like I said, we were a super tight family, and you get the humanity I tell through those stories.
Yeah.
When someone asks me about the love in our family, the things that turn me on and make me feel so much from the way I grew up, I always tell those stories of discipline that people go, put their hand over their mouth. They're the ones that turn me on and go, no, that showed the love. That's how my mom and dad communicate. That's not how I communicate now with my wife. I don't choose to do that. It's not how I raise my kids with the discipline.
You mean you guys don't have a standoff with tools and knives and forks,
12-inch blades, and ketchup bottles,
bloody each other, and
and then make love on the kitchen floor
in front of your kids?
Well, that's the other thing.
Yeah,
there was that's another thing. They were not chick. No, there. If you look at that story, beautiful part about how they perceived each other is you didn't. Neither one of them had one iota of a thought of like, oh, wait a minute. Our son, who's whatever, 4 years old, is over there. Maybe we should make this R-rated instead of NC-17. Or there was no, objectify the situation. They were the subject. They're in it. If you're there to witness it and you're in the seats, well, saddle on up, big boy. And then I chose to leave once the lovemaking
started. But you're four. You chose to leave because it got weird.
No, because I was crying. The fight was finally over. I was so happy the fight was finally over. And the knife had been dropped and the ketchup bottle had been dropped. And all I know is whatever they were doing before, they weren't fighting.
But you don't, like, on some, I get it, but on some level, I mean, you have to look, like, I just read a whole book of you sort of constructing who you were and who you are and being hyper aware of a system to be put in place so you can become the man you want to be. And you're going to tell me that four-year-old that was sitting there watching shit being thrown and ketchup everywhere and crying wasn't sort of like, these people aren't going to help me exactly.
No, I thought I come 100% said these people, never even in context. No, 100% these are my mom and dad that love me. This is a wild rodeo. And wow, I guess this is one way to do it. I mean, I didn't contextualize it at 4 years
right,
old.
Right.
And I also
not.
Wasn't something that I got to be older and was like, you know, I really got to go talk that out about what that meant to me. I kind of immediately saw it as like, I brought it up to mom after that. What the hell was that about? And,
yeah.
and she just straight up, like she said, hey, that's how I needed that to communicate.
Yeah.
My finger's broken four times because I needed that to communicate. She started on fights. She admits it to this day.
Right. I'm not leaning on the therapy angle. I'm just leaning on the angle. I just think it's sort of interesting that you present all this chaos, which is their mm-hmm. love and however you want to define that. It's hard to explain relationships, but also alongside of that, you know, this book is really about self-parenting, dude. I mean, it's not about pathology. It's not like I have problems,
right.
but it's really about these are like, I look back at my life and this is how I became the man I'm going to be. And, you know, you credit your folks.
Heard.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Heard. I hear you. I mean, self-parenting, self-determination.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk about not being reliant on fate at the same time.
Yeah.
That it's going to happen with or without us. And after it happens, it's a science. But yeah, you know, and look, in a constant recalibration,
right?
Just many times through the story, I think I've got my shit all together. And I about face step and shit and see, you know, spit the loogie in my face, proverbial loogie in my face, right when I think I'm in the cradle of God, you know? I mean, so part of the humor and the leaning into to our my own impermanence and our own impermanence of humanity is part of the identity
sure.
that there's not that I'm never going to, we're never going to find it. That's the point. So let's dance through this son of a bitch as best we can. You know, forgive where we can persist where we need to and put ourselves through hell, but also shake hands on some things, say, hey, I'm stuck with you. You're the only person I can't get rid of.
Yeah.
Hey, you're the only person you can't get rid of, Mark. So hell, since we're here, shit, might as well try and get along.
Yeah. With the guy inside. So, like, where are you, in Austin now?
Yeah.
You ever go out there to Opie's Barbecue in Spicewood?
Love Opie's. One of my favorite three tastes in my mouth ever is that sausage dipped in that jalapeno corn.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. It's so, yeah. so good.
So, you know Kristen and that gang out there?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my place. I always go out there.
It's killer.
They sent me a bunch at the beginning of the quarantine. She sent me a big package.
They came out and cooked it. We had my wife threw a 50th birthday party for me out in Marfa, where we flew in people, friends from the West Coast and friends from Austin, and we were all spent 3 days camping out in tents out there. And Opie's opening night, we had them. They did the barbecue, man.
Yeah, I love it. And a lot of people don't know about it, but I talk about it constantly. I think I've definitely sent a lot of people over there.
I'd never heard about it. I just recently got turned on to it just about a year and a half ago from neighbor friend of ours.
Well, it's nice because it's still off the beaten path and it's not crazy. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's that level of barbecue. I mean, it's all pretty good, you know, but they do some stuff that's real good. Their sausage is real good.
Now, that sauce is dunked yeah. in the jalapeno corn.
I'm with you. And get the cobbler, down. The cobbler, they got.
If you can make it, then after the cobbler's what gives me, if I want to go take a nap, have the cobbler after eating all that barbecue.
With that vanilla ice cream, with that bluebell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Get
Come
down.
On, man. So do you hang out with Willie?
Not that often. I see him and Annie and Lucas from time to time.
Right.
I mean, last time I saw Willie, Woody and I went out there to his ranch there in Austin, played cards all night.
Yeah. So it's not a regular thing. I'm just trying to think of people I know in Austin.
It's not, I mean, not a regular thing. You know, I mean, if he comes in town and he's going to play a show and sometimes I'll go introduce him, or like I said, we played card a couple times.
Yeah.
I have not ever seen him in Hawaii, which he spends a lot of time out there.
Yeah. Now Linkletter, do you guys hang out?
Yeah. Actually just wrote with Linkletter this morning. He just read the book and wrote back what he thought of it.
What do you think of it?
He loved it. I got my doggone eyes got wet after reading what he thought of it.
Oh, really?
Because I really value his opinion, and he's a guy who chooses his words carefully. And he had so much to say that he liked about it. And he actually, then he ended it with saying, "Look, it's a great living object to be dropping into the world at this time." And you know, he also said this. He goes, "One of my favorite things about the book is what it is not." He goes, it's not a gossip tell-all industry, you know, story. No. Oh, I should have had this part. You should have given me this. And I, you know, and he was like, it's not that at all.
Yeah, you kind of avoid that almost.
Yeah. I mean, those people know who they are. I don't want to spend time on a page trying to call them out. I call it one person and I don't name them with the Reign of Fire story when I shave my head.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But no, I was never, my goal going into it, I knew, I was like, okay, here I am. McConaughey going to write a book. I want to go see what all my diaries are. I think there may be something worthy in there. But I know that coming out as McConaughey, I'm going to share the book. I'm going to have some people that are going to be, oh, I want to read it right away because McConaughey wrote it. I got other people that are going to go, I'm not reading that fucking book. I don't need to read another fucking book by a celebrity. What's he doing writing a book?
Yeah.
Guy's got a family, successful actor. What, now he's going to write? Come on. You know, yeah. You got that side. So I said, look, and I told the publishers early on, one of the first things I wrote, I said, look, this should never end up being between hardcovers. Any kind of hardcover, if the words are not worthy to be signed by Anonymous, but at the same time, when you read it, it should be only McConaughey could have wrote this.
No, it definitely feels that way. I mean, think that's what drives you the experience, is that like, it's definitely you. So that comes through. Cool. That's what makes you finish the book, is because
all right,
you're talking like you and you can picture you doing the shit.
I did it. I tell you this, man, I've been, you know, as a performer, I perform the stories around many campfires, many dinner parties.
Sure,
I tell stories.
Yeah.
Now, I thought, here, I'm going to go put them to the page. Why don't I just record my best version of the story and dictate that and put it on the page? Well, guess what? That don't work. The writing has to be like, from my experience, 30% shorter than the telling.
Right. You got to transcribe it, though. Like it's good to have those transcripts and then tighten it up.
Exactly. The transcripts helped, but then I did have to do a lot of typing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's the way I did a book, and it was taken from a lot of talking. And you got to tighten it up. It's better because it gives you a framework, and then you can get in there and you can sort of reflect a little bit within it. Right.
Yep.
You know, you got the story, and then you're like, oh, but here I could kind of go back to this, you know, which you wouldn't do in the telling, but in the writing, you can kind of draw it out a little longer.
Well, in the telling, you can, you don't get this intonation that I'm leading up to a certain fact, and you see my raised eyebrow, and my voice is a little higher, and I'm teeing you up for the punchline.
Yeah.
But in the writing, you don't get all that. So you have to choose your words more carefully. And like you said, go back, because I would also write something down and I'd have my editor read it, and they missed the story. They missed the moral of the story. They didn't get that it was a joke, or they didn't get that it was had the humanity in it. And they'd be like, oh my God, this is so mean. Or I'm like, no, what did you miss? And I took for granted, I was giving you the Cliff Notes version of what I've already known. So I need to go back and remember you're reading it for the first time.
Describe it.
Yeah.
So now, like, talking to Linkletter, I mean, that guy is really, it must mean a lot to you. I mean, he's the guy that started this whole journey for you, really.
Yep.
And, you know, had that faith in you at the beginning, right? Yeah. And like, I didn't realize until that how much of that story of how that happened, you know, and then being on set in the improvising, because you approached that thing, you had no acting training, really, right?
No, I'd been in a Miller Lite commercial for about that long.
A Miller Lite commercial, but that was it.
Background model.
But you always had a certain amount of swagger. The swagger carried you.
Yeah, I walked. My shoulders were usually somewhat back.
Yeah, you were never a wallflower. You're not some you weren't hiding from anything. I would say that probably.
No, okay.
If I knew you in high school, you know, I would be with the group of guys that would turn and go like, "Nah, fucking McConaughey."
No, there's no. That's the thing. Here's the thing, though, dude. Here's the thing. Here's who I was in high school.
Yeah.
I got two fights in high school. They were both for taking up for an underdog who was getting picked on. One guy was named Ronald Halley, who was the nerd who sat on the front row.
Yeah.
And he was getting picked on. Another was a short black kid who was getting picked on. I got in fights defending those. I was the only friend. I was popular. I was in student council. I had straight A's. I had a 4 handicap. I had a truck. I was good looking. I was affluent. Bah, 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 bah. At the same time,
all right.
I was the only one that was really, I was really good friends with Betty Rice.
Yeah.
The first gothic, everyone thought she was the lesbian in high school. And yeah. Betty was cool as shit.
Yeah.
Betty and I got along. So I was cool with the in and out groups. I was. I was cool with the nerds. I was cool with the non-athletes.
Yeah.
I was cool with. I was cool with most everybody.
Not a dick.
I was never a dick. No. I was not a dick. Nah. I had fun with all kinds, and I also like guys like Bendler, who's the guy who robbed Bendler, who I met in art class, who gave me the courage to even pursue going into a film career. He was the artistic guy whose dad was an interior decorator and the Jewish kid who was kind of, you know, kept to his own. Well, I would bring him out on the Friday nights to the truck at the dead end with the kegger and the music with all my popular friends. Let's drink some beer and chase the girls.
Yeah.
I'd bring him into that group and I was always with him. And they're like, well, what's he doing around? Until they met him, like, oh, he's really cool.
Right.
All right, exactly. And then on Saturday night, he introduced me to something I'd never done.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't you come over to my house and let's watch a movie?
Yeah.
And do some writing. What? Saturday night, we got two nights to go chase girls and drink beers. Like, oh, let's try this. And so that was the first time I got introduced to any sort of introversion through him.
Or you know, that type of creativity. But you were open to it for some reason, which is interesting. I wonder why that was. I mean, I guess you don't have to question it. You just had a big heart for people, I guess.
I guess I also, you know, I've always had that side to me. Like I say about my dad.
Yeah.
I mean, look at my dad. You go, football player, Green Bay Packers, 6'4", 260, bear of a man. Work your way up through a job, son. That's how we do it. Hard work. That gets us there.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time, the guy took ballet. At the same time, he was a painter. After he passed away, I found paintings of his. I found sculptures of his. I'm like, when was he doing that, Mom?
Really?
After I went to bed, oh, yeah, he'd go off in the garage and do that. Never showed us. So we had it in us. It just wasn't something that was out in front. Or like I said, when I decided to go to film school, the idea of going to film school in my 18-year-old, 19-year-old head was, well, that's too avant-garde, European, hippy-dippy. You can't do that. You know, it's like, you got to work your shit. As soon as I told him I want to go to film school, and he said, don't half-ass it. He was so happy. In our family, this is it. And I think it was this way for society in general in a lot of ways. You set up rules. Here's the rules, the laws. And until you break them and you go, I'm not asking permission to break them.
Yeah.
And guess what? Consequences be Dan. That's when my dad was like, yeah, you broke out and went your own way. You look at society, a private sector, a Steve Jobs, a somebody goes and goes their own way, and Elon Musk. All the rules say you can't do that until you do it and you play so well that you're on the starting five just because you've done it. And then everybody, the government and families go, okay, bravo, good job. You went far enough to break the mold.
Do you think your dad had saw himself and you in the way that he couldn't quite, you know, manifest that part of himself? So he was, you know, like, because it seems like there was a lot tied up in your own sense of masculinity and, you know, wanting to be approved by your dad in sense of your manhood, but him having this sort of secret creative life that he kind of kept hidden, that like, because it was a very interesting and emotional turn for you to say you're going to film school and thinking that, you know, he would, you know, at least be hard on you about it. And instead he just wants you to do the best that you can. Speaks to his, you know, to maybe that part of him that's sort of like, you know, I got a garage full of paintings and I never had the courage to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that may be two levels too deep for the way he was thinking. I think it was more like he appreciated my independent rebellious spirit to go against everything that was expected of me, even by him. Yeah. And in an immediate 10 seconds, he was already inside smiling, going, there we go. Paving his own path, daring himself. You damn right I'm for it. Don't half-ass it.
Yeah. It's too bad, man. He didn't, he like, and he passed away during
5 days. 5 days into my first day of shooting Days of Confused.
And it was a complete surprise. You didn't know?
Complete surprise. I got a call. I always find out about death in the damn kitchen.
Yeah.
I'm always in the kitchen when I get the phone call about somebody close to me dying.
That's good for, that's cinematic, you know? You're doing some stuff in the kitchen. The phone rings. Hello? And then you stand there. And...
yeah. Yeah, something. What? Something, right? Yeah. I always hit my knees, too. And I remember I got the call. It was the night. It was the Monday night. So he had made love to my mother, climax, and had a heart attack that morning at 6:30. Mom didn't call me until 7 o'clock that night. I never asked her why she waited. But she called me, and it was real good. And I could tell she was catching her breath. She goes, Matthew, you there? Can you hear me? Yeah. Yolanda? I go, yes, man. What's up? She goes, your dad died. And I was, you know, shocked, hit my knees, blah, 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 and composed myself, got a cup of coffee and jug of water and hit the road and drove home.
Yeah.
That was a complete surprise. Complete surprise. Now, we had found out, you know, dad smoked like, you know, 2-3 packs of filterless Camels a day.
Oh, really?
So he had gone to, you know, like Baylor Medical, where they did this experiment where they put the dye in you to see how your aorta and everything's running.
Yeah.
And he'd come back. And the next day we'd be on the golf course, he'd have a cigarette. I'd go, Pop, you sure you're supposed to be smoking that? He's, oh, yeah, son. Doc says I got the heart of a 22-year-old high hurdler. Well, so boom, he has a heart attack. And we're like, the whole family, we're going to get that doctor. We're going to get his ass. Well, we barge down there going, you didn't tell us. You told our dad had a heart of a 22-year-old high hurdler. You son of a bitch. You said he could keep smoking. He's like, what? No. Look at these graphs. I told him, don't ever smoke again. You're all clogged up and blocked. They're like, huh? He's completely bullshit.
But you guys were ready to go.
Oh, we were ready to take that doc out. And then all of a sudden, we were just like, oh, shit. Well, of course. Okay.
Yeah, he didn't want to change.
Nah.
He's going to go out. And he went out fucking. That's something.
Called the shot. Always told his boys, when I get out of this place, I'm going to be making love to your mother.
He did
and
say.
Son of a bitch if he didn't.
Come on. He said that?
He said that. When I go, boys, I'm going to be making love to your mother. And then sure enough, you know, and he went. There's other still parts of the story that aren't even in the book. He evidently, I found out later, because when the ambulance came to get him at the house, obviously all the neighbors came out in the street.
Right.
And the neighbors all, that were somewhat friends came and told me later that mom, in her negligee nightie that she had woke up in, wouldn't let the paramedics cover him. She kept ripping the sheet off going, uh-uh. I want the world to see why his nickname was Big Jim. Don't you cover him. That's how he went out.
Come on.
Looney Tunes, man. Carney is all get out.
Well, it's funny because that sort of ties into you being busted and refusing to put the blanket on because you wanted to prove
the
point.
Maybe that's where I got it from. Yeah. Prove my innocence. Yeah. My birthday suit is obvious. A picture shows that I was minding my own business.
Yes. Yeah. That was it.
In my mind.
Runs in the family. So yeah. When you're shooting Days and Confuso, like, are you paralyzed with grief or are you able to just kind of move past it or use it or what was the feeling?
Definitely more grounded. So here, this first thing happens. I get my first acting job. I love it. People are telling me I'm good at it. I'm getting invited back to set. I'm like getting paid $320 a day. I'm thinking, is this legal? Can I get away with this? Having a great time on a high of my life. Bam, that happens. Well, what had just become the most important thing in my life, getting my first job in acting that I loved, became an obvious distant second. And so I came back and was very thoughtful. I remember walking around the football field in that final scene of Days Confused. It was just before sunset, and Rick Linklater and I were walking around. I just got back from my dad's wake And we were just talking about, hey, what's it all about? Life. And I said, you know what, man, I think it's about you just keep living, man. I mean, like my dad, he's now gone, but I have an opportunity to keep alive in me what he taught me about what I loved and why I loved him. And if I keep that alive, he may physically not be here, but spiritually he's still alive. So I have that opportunity. So I think just got to keep living, man. And then that night in that scene, I said it to Randall Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted to sign the drug contract. And I was like, you know what you do when you are, you're going to get a whole lot more rules once you get older. Whatever you do, you just got to keep living, man. And then that sort of just sat on me as I do, I'll find a phrase or a bumper sticker or an aphorism, and I'll test it in life and take it into life and see, does it apply or where does it not apply? Can it hold up? And look, it's a simple one, but just keep living. Even Chekhov said it. What else are we here to do?
Sure.
I've never found a place where it's not applicable.
And I like that. All right, all right, all right was just sort of a throwaway. And then it became the defining phrase of your life.
The three affirmations of the things my character had at that time, Wooderson.
Yeah.
He had his car, 70 Chevelle. He had his weed because Slater's riding shotgun. And he had Ted Nugent in the 8-track. So he had his rock and roll. And he was going to get the fourth thing that he loved, which was go pick up the chicks.
Yeah.
And pulling out, after putting in drive, I said those three words. There was also, I had been listening to a lot of the Doors at that time. And there's a recording of Morrison in a live concert where he barks to the crowd four times. All right, all right, all right, all right. So maybe that was somewhere in the back of my mind too.
Yeah.
To do it in Wooderson sort of way. And then just laid down the three affirmations of what I had. And those are the first three words I ever said in film. So the reason I love it when people say it,
yeah,
or tattoo it on them or whatever, and walk down the street and say half, you know, and say half of it. And I say the other half.
Yeah.
Those are the first three words I said ever on film 28 years ago. Now, I didn't know at that time if that was going to be a one-off hobby where I got to work for a week in the summer of 1992 and never did it again. But it turned out to be a career. So I'm like, please. I'm in. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
That was
all
it.
All right. All right.
That was the baptism. That was it.
Come on.
But I think it's interesting that the one part of whatever you do to sort of identify with these characters, like, you know, you talk about that it was one line he said. That, like, you know,
launchpad line.
Right. And that's your tool.
Yeah. A launchpad line.
Like Wooderson, it was, what was it? Like, I'm going to get older.
What I love about those high school girls, man. I get older. They stay the same age.
And you were like,
dude, I read that. I'm like, who's that guy?
Yeah.
If that guy really believes that, that line is not an attitude.
Yeah.
If that's like part of his constitution, there's an encyclopedia on that guy.
Right.
In that belief. It's like the Wolf of Wall Street.
Right.
The way I was able to riff on that was one of the lines that were written he tells the Jordan Belfort, the Leonardo DiCaprio character, the secret to stockbroking is cocaine and hookers. I'm like, what? Who's that guy?
Yeah. Right.
There's a book on that guy, if that's truly his perspective. And he really means that. A launch pad line.
Right. But that, like, it's that's how you start, because you refer to these guys as your man, you know, like, yeah. And so you're going to take that. That's your window into them to put that together, to write that book.
Bingo.
Right.
To write that book. Then the rap starts. I can write that song.
Yeah.
Now, hundreds, thousands of pages based off of that one liner. Unpack that. Deconstruct that guy.
Right. And right after you do, like, you know, like Dazed and Confused, then you have this kind of run. Like you work with Sales, right? John Sales.
John Sales on Lone Star.
Because that was an interesting movie.
Yep.
And like, so like you're working with, you work with Linklater and you work with Sales, and they seem pretty organic about their process. I mean, those are kind of movie makers. It's a good way to start.
Oh yeah. What a great way to start. I mean, they weren't huge budget studio films where the machine is kind of leading the personal side of things. They weren't huge, you know, studio movies that you had money to pay for everything.
Right.
So you had to get more creative and independent. You have to sort of be able to adapt quicker.
And they both have a vision. Stories. They got a vision.
Yeah, they have a vision, and they're more personal. They're not the spend on those are not for the star in the movie or the special effects. So it's just interpersonal. The story's got to be written well, and let's see what story we tell on the ground through human interaction. So I saw collaboration is what I saw. And I went into Dazed Confused thinking that like directing was a dictatorship. And like, if you didn't know something, you were obviously failing as a director. I'd see Linklater pick up an idea from a PA. I'd see Linklater go to a spot like that night when he came to me. He just told me this about a month ago. When he came to me that night, my very first night, I was not supposed to be in the movie. I had not been in the movie at all yet. I was just doing a wardrobe and makeup test, and he came up and he goes, "Oh, I look at you. Yes, you look like Wooderson." And then he goes, "Hey, man, you know, I figure Wooderson's the kind of guy who's been with the typical hot chicks, you know, the cheerleaders, majorettes and stuff." And I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "Do you think he'd have an interest in the redheaded intellectual?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah, Wooderson likes all types of chicks, man." And he goes, "Well, you know, Marissa Ribisi's over playing. You think you maybe pull up and pick her up?"
Yeah.
Well, I said, "Yeah," but I found that 2 months ago that actually 15 minutes before that, Rick was on the set and noticed, without having anything to do with me, that, oh, I got a story hole in our story right now. Nobody, who's going to tell everyone there's a party tonight? No one knows there's a party tonight to get everyone to go.
Yeah.
So he comes and he says he sees me. He goes like, "Well, maybe Wooderson could be the one that says there's a fiesta in the making tonight." And so he gave that to me because he needed a story point. He didn't tell me that until 2 months ago.
Yeah, I know, because the story's in the book about would you hit on the redhead? Now he tells you, it's like, "Oh yeah, I just need."
Yeah, I needed you to fill a story. I need you to move my narrative along, man.
So the big break is a Time to Kill, right?
That's the big, yeah.
And that
that's
guy,
the big.
What was the? What
that's
was the?
Joel Schumacher.
Right. Well, what was that guy? What was the story? What was the line that got you into that guy?
So the line that got me into that guy, well, with that character,
yeah.
I mean, look, I'll say this. I knew even at that point that if that final summation doesn't nail the truth,
right,
then it doesn't matter what the rest of my performance is like. That the turn in that story depends on Jake Brigance delivering that final summation and hitting and getting the jury into that world, and then making the flip where he goes, "Now imagine she's white."
Right.
Akiva Goldsman wrote that. And I knew early on, I was like, this summation is the thing that has to work. If this doesn't work, no matter how good you do in the rest of the movie, the movie doesn't work and your performance won't work unless you nail this. And that, you know, that summation, I had that day flagged in my calendar for months. And once we got to it, I remember going in, I was very, very calm that day. I was prepared. I was very calm. I knew it was a big moment for me.
Right.
And I remember Joel Schumacher going, "Okay, so Matthew, we're in there in the rehearsal." And he goes, I'm gonna shoot the jury first. We'll do the wide shots. You can warm your way up into it." And I wasn't even looking at him. I was kind of gazing off. I was already in my zone. And he was saying that, and I was not agreeing with him. And I just kind of glanced out of my eye and I went. And he goes, without missing a beat, he goes, "And we're gonna shoot the wide." "No, I take that back. We're shooting Jake Brigance's close up first. Everyone get ready." And everyone came in, shoop, cover me first, one take. Bam, move on.
Oh, so you did that was it. You did that close up first because you didn't want to do it.
I didn't. I said he could tell I was locked in. I let him know without saying I was locked in. And so he said, "We're not going to shoot everything first and let you warm up. We're going to cover you right now first because you're ready."
Right. And then that was it, man. Then all of a sudden, I remember the press. It's like the new Paul Newman is here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is the guy.
Saves the movies.
What the fuck, dude?
Right. Oh, it was wild, dude. It was wild. I remember going through, you know, hell, going to the supermarket, getting my groceries.
Yeah.
Looking at three magazine covers, and I'm on the cover of them going like, "Well, I think I'll purchase a few of those." Remember, you know? But then I remember it was, and I write about it in the book, the world became a mirror.
Yeah.
Everything got inverted. The Friday before it came out, the Friday afternoon of the day it came out.
Yeah.
Like I said, there are 100 scripts out there I would have said yes to. And there were 99 no's and one yes. Bam, it opens up Friday night. It has a good opening weekend. That Monday, it inverted. 100 scripts I want to do, 99 yeses, one no. And I was like, whoa, 3 days ago, I would have done any of these. And now it's on me. And last time I checked, there's only 24 hours in a day. It's on me to be discerning through 99 of these scripts to decide what I want to do. Let me catch my breath here.
Right. And, you know? And so, have you been with the same agent forever?
No. Oh. That was at the time I was with, that was right around transition, I think, when I went from William Morris over to CA. I believe that was a transition time.
Because like those decisions, I mean, like it's interesting because in the book, when you talk about the career and you talk about like how, like, because you didn't take a lot of acting classes, but once you got to LA, you felt like you should. So you did.
Yeah.
And you felt like it fucked you up somehow.
It did. You know that transition when you learn a new craft. Something, if you have an instinctual understanding of something.
Yeah.
And you kind of do it pretty good. And then you go, let's go get learned.
Right.
Let's get the intellect and let's learn something. There's a bridge you have to cross where there's an awkward period there where for the first time you're conscious of what you're doing and you're learning how to do what you were just doing naturally.
Of course, yeah, but it's also according to this one person you decide to trust with the education, right? So you go to this class and all of a sudden because you have an instinct for it and you're good at it, but you want to get better at it. So it's like, who's this guy? Well, these people told me this is the guy. And then you go listen to the guy.
No, and it didn't work. I was too tight. I had an awkward couple of years there where I was not getting the parts because I was thinking too much.
Really?
Now, later on, as in my career, I did get with a wonderful lady, one of my great mentors, like Penny Allen, and really dove into what acting was, what my rights were as an actor.
What movie was that?
Really,
when did that start?
Script. That started right before EdTV and went up to 2 years ago, and she just passed away from cancer. And that's one of the most important people in my life. I was with her for, I think, 19 years.
As a coach.
Yeah, she wouldn't call herself a coach, but she was, I don't even know what to call her. She was people that worked with her know that she's like no other. She had no connection to the business side. She had no connection that like, oh, this movie, it's got a studio behind it. This could be a big deal. She didn't care if it was getting offered $1 or $10 million. She was just only about the role and what was right, what was truest for me. And she just pushed me. Now that she did, as Don Phillips says, lower my handicap as an actor. That first foray did not.
Well, it's interesting because like your instinct around the idea of the line, what'd you call it? The launchpad line, you know, and building out from that, you know, that, I mean, that's teachable. You know, like that, you know, that's like, but any actor, I think most great actors are naturally 80% of it is just a gift, you know, and then, then the other 20 is some education and also just doing it over and over again. But I mean, that's as good a tool as any acting coach is going to give you is like, here's your launch pad line. See, you know, figure out what the book of the character is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. But also, I learned more from her. Like, there's a lot more to it. It's like, you go, well, don't just rely on the one launch pad line that you think your character takes literally. Let's see who he is, but let's also see who he is not. Let's see what they need. What is their obstacle they got to get over to get what they need? So it's not all just easy street. What, you know, the who am I? The launch pad line helps a lot with the who am I in a character. But also, I learned a lot about how to get out of trouble when I got in trouble. If I got stuck, if I got tight, if I had tension, tension's an actor's worst enemy. If I had tension on set, I learned how to get out of trouble. Mm. I learned when to go walk off and take a moment, when to go shake it out. Okay. Come back. Let's reapproach this situation.
Right.
And I learned how to arm myself, so to speak, how to come to a set with like, I got four versions in the truth and my holsters are loaded.
Yeah.
So you can, let's call the audible, press record. You can throw at me whatever you want. I want to be able to just, I can go with it. I can dance with it, whatever you give me. And that's when it's really fun. When as actors, we're really hitting it on the screws is when it's like, don't even say cut. If you got a million hours of film, video, press record right now and put a blindfold on me, wherever you want to go, keep the recorder on. I'll be my guy.
Right.
That's when it's like,
that's when you like it.
Doesn't always happen, but that's when it's like, ooh.
Yeah. That's what makes it worth it. That and the money.
Yeah.
So when did the two primary, it seems like there were three primary kind of like necessary recalibrating spiritual journeys that you had to take because of some existential crisis, right? Yep. And that's a lot of the book in a way. It kind of hangs on these things. And they're interesting to me. I mean, outside of the fact that they were all sort of, you know, driven by wet dreams that were non-sexual, which that's nice. Good for you. But...
Good for you. Good for you. Hey, way to be the one. Congratulations, Connie. Next.
Yeah. When did the first one to Africa, when did that happen? Because, I mean, but also, like, I think the living in the trailer thing, it's hard for me to sort of see in the context of the career and in time. Like, you know, you took two trips to Africa, a trip to a monastery, but you also lived in a mobile home for, what, years? Months?
Yeah, about 4 years.
Four years. So you brought the business to you when it needed to come to you. You know, and you were
or
in.
I drove my Airstream to Vancouver.
But
or
you were in
Detroit
demand at that time. It wasn't like you were on the outs at that time. This was a lifestyle.
No, I was in somewhat demand, yes.
Because that was a lifestyle choice. This is how I'm going to live to make me me. I'm going to be out on the road with my dog, living life, meeting real people. So what happened when you hit the wall enough to, like, you know, really check out and go to Africa the first time?
Well, so the first I had the
nocturnal emission,
hands free, palatial free nocturnal emission. The first one was in, I think, in 96, and that one sent me to Peru. As I knew in the dream, there were two things I knew to be facts in the dream. There was the Amazon River and African tribes been on the left bank, as far as the eye.
Two separate dreams. Right?
No, that's the same dream.
That's the first
same
one.
Exact dream. Oh. 11 frames, 11 seconds. Snapshot. I'm floating down the river on the Amazon River on my back, wrapped up in anacondas. Freshwater sharks are swirling, crocodiles and piranhas. On my back, naked. There's African tribesmen with shields and spears all on the left bank above me, all the way as far as the eye can see. Then I came.
Right.
It was not a nightmare. I go, oh, geez, I wake up from that. What is that? That's got to be someone's telling me something here. What do I know about those? I know it's the Amazon. I know it's African tribesmen. So as I say in the book, I go to the Atlas for Africa looking for the Amazon. Wrong continent. So I didn't find the Amazon. I say, I'm going there. I go for a 22-day trip to float the Amazon. That story's in there. I think, okay, I fulfilled it. I have the dream again. I had it again in 99.
I know, but like when you go down there, like, okay, so, you know, it's only 21 days, but it's a pretty big journey. And, like, what was it? Because all these times, you know, you're having these existential crises and, you know, you seem to feel like you have to pay some penance for something.
Yep.
I mean, what was the cleansing thing? What did you have to, you know, what was it that you had to reconfigure to go down there? Like, what were you like, I got to fucking do this because why?
Well, I mean, look, it was a celestial suggestion to me that I took quite seriously.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I did not know exactly what I was going needed to go find, but I was like, this is a wonderful excuse to get the fuck out of here and go off on your own. And you know what? I'm going to say that's probably a good idea anyway for somebody anytime they can do it, but right now, since you got that celestial suggestion through this wet dream, this one may have a higher hand, and let's go chase it down and see what we get out of it. So then I have that dream, same dream again over three years later, and I'm in the northern side of the Liffey in the Morrison Hotel, just finished Rain of Fire in Ireland.
Yeah,
had the exact same dream, 11 frames, 11 seconds, wet dream, and I'm like, whoa, hadn't had that in 3 years, but it's the same one I had then. Well, maybe it's calling me out to do the second half of my dream. What's the second half? The other thing that I know about the dream geographically, African tribesmen. Okay, I guess I need to go to Africa.
Now that I got the river part done, I gotta go.
I got the river part done.
What are the
now
Africans doing there?
So I go, I gotta chase down the second half.
Yeah.
Now I'm going mighty big continent. What's my coordinate over there, baby? Listening to music, Ali Farkatour. Wait a minute, that guy's Africa. Where's he from? Check him out. He's from Niafunke. Where's Niafunke? Oh, it's in Mali. Okay, I'm going to go find Ali.
Yeah.
Didn't know anything more than that. And headed off, found Ali about 5 days into the trip and ended up taking the rest of the greatest trip of my life for the next 17 days after that.
So these were just sort of like impulsive, cosmically informed journeys that you had the wherewithal and the financial freedom to take, and you wanted to just see what would happen.
Damn right. And felt like, and like I said, always looking for an excuse to go take an adventure or a solo to chase down a mystery.
Sure. And they all feed your character. I mean, like that whole story in Africa, you know, around the wrestling, that was exciting and fun. And you developed a friendship with the guy who drove you, like your guide. Mm-hmm. You know, that's exciting.
Yep.
Okay, so then getting to the monastery that we started the conversation with, it seemed to me that you had somehow, because like what's interesting about the book is that you have these events in your life that you thread together as defining events, right? But there are definitely periods in your life and moments in your life that you either, you kind of move through by going like, you know, there's a couple of references to, I got to cleanse myself of these sins. And also like, you know, like this, an intensity of loathing. So like, you know, like,
yeah.
And, but you know, you don't write about either of those things.
Well, I mean, but I didn't look, my threshold, I have a pretty short threshold for my own feeling of self-guilt.
Mm.
And my own feeling of self-significance. My threshold's pretty quick. I mean, I have a pretty sensitive wire when I'm feeling like, whoa, hang on, McConaughey. You're not being all of you right now. You're not grounded. Your mind and your heart and your spirit do not have an autobahn between them right now. You've got some blocked roads here and you need to clear this up. And oh, why have you been thinking that? Geez, you've been kind of looking down on things. You're thinking negatively. I didn't like what you said last night. Huh. How you said that. Right. What was constructive about that, McConaughey? What are you trying to be somebody else? And so those triggers let me know, hey, my spider senses go off and go, you need to check in. You need to bend a knee, boy.
Yeah.
You know, you need to go check out to check in. And whether that is going to the monastery and praying or going off into nature, those are all fugamundis, as my brother Christian friend Monk calls them, that are walkabouts, which are to say, I'm going to go to a place where I can listen to myself. I'm in a position of fame at that time in my life where there's a lot of frequencies coming at me.
Yeah.
There's a lot, 24 hours a day, I got a lot coming at me. A lot of voices, a lot of things I'm listening to, a lot of things I think I am and I want to be. All of a sudden, you can start objectifying your life and go, wait, where's the subject? And so I'm feeling like I'm living an object in my life and going, wait a minute, but I don't feel my own feet on the ground.
Right.
I need to go somewhere where I can hear myself think. I need to go somewhere where memory can catch up with me, where I can go, okay, let's have this out, McConaughey. Let's go back over the old docket here and see what we've been doing over the last year. And let's measure them out. And let's figure out which ones we're going to forgive and which ones we're going to say, I'm fucking tired of that no more.
Right.
And I want to do, and I'm going to have that out with myself. Let's go have that wrestling match until we get to a point, which is usually around day 12, that there's a purge. There's a forgiveness period where I go, okay, all right.
Right.
Stuck with the one person I can't get rid of. So let's shake hands on this, McConaughey, and see how we can do from here on out. And we'll screw up again and need another one of these soon. But for now, let's have a good time and be more present.
Right. And that works, you know, like, because you go deep with it. Like, you know, you don't. So you, most of the time, it seemed like that first time it was about, you know, that line that you cross where you're no longer defined by yourself, but by the business's expectations, other people's expectations, the, you know, whatever the fans' expectations.
Yeah.
But alongside of that, you got all this bread and you can do whatever the fuck you want. And there's no way you're not going to get into a decadence hole because you've lost your way.
That's what I didn't want to get into, a decadence hole. Like I said, I write about the value of resistance
in
my life a lot. You just said it. I got all this dough, can do whatever the fuck I want. Whoop. Well, that's a prescription for becoming a tyrant.
A tyrant.
Or, unless you check in.
Or dead.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I didn't want those. So I'm going, well, wait a minute, man. What's you know, how can I? So I needed too many options. I needed to decrease options. I needed to hear myself. I write about it with the pressed jeans.
Oh, yeah. That's a good analogy.
When you can, ask yourself if you want to before you do. So with success becomes all of this, I can.
Right.
For the first time, I can. So shit, yeah, I want to. Well, all of a sudden you go, wait a minute. Some of this stuff isn't really feeding me back. It's not really good for me. So hang on, let me check in
But I was just saying yes because I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah, look, they're giving me free jackets. They got look at these hats. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Well, what was
it? I needed to start to find a little discernment.
What was it? Where were you? What were you shooting when that happened? They put you up in where was it? In Arizona, with the maid and the.
Yeah, yeah, that was Boys on the Side.
Right. And what was that story? That friend of yours comes up?
So I get this little great little adobe guest house on the edge of this like Saguaro National Forest there. I mean, coyotes howling right outside my door. Great little one bedroom loft. It's got a nice kitchen. And it comes with a maid.
Right.
The housekeeper. I've never had one before, man. She's making me great food, breakfast, and scrambled eggs, and leaving me a dinner at night, and having it set out, and making my bed, and all this stuff, leaving water next to my bed, cleaning stuff up. And she also starts pressing my jeans.
Right.
Like, with that little fine line right down the front leg. Hey, and yeah. I have my friend over, Beth right. Alexander, who's now moved on. And I'm like telling her this stuff, like it's my birthday, like I just told you.
Yeah.
And I went and I said, look at this, man. She even presses my jeans. And she was just laughing. She goes, well, that's great, Matthew. I said, right. She goes, if you want your jeans pressed. And I went, I hate that fucking line on my jeans. I never thought of that before.
It's the worst. But, but I like that became this sort of point of wisdom, you know, where you know, that was the click, you know, like,
It clicked to go. Yeah.
What I want? I don't have to take everything, even though
you don't have to take everything, even though for the first time in my life, I can get all these things I never got before. So yeah, when you can ask yourself if you want to before you do.
Now, were you brought up with Jesus?
Yeah, we were brought up Methodist, which is heavy on the New Testament. You know, heavy on the thanks.
Yeah.
Heavy on the gratitude. Not so much the Baptist Old Testament. If you don't do this, then you're going to hell. It was a lot of forgiveness and gratitude.
Yeah, and do you stay with that when you do these walkabouts and stuff? Is that who you go to generally, or is it broader?
I mean, it's one of the places I go to because I read a lot of great. I've read a lot of wonderful stuff that I appreciate through Jesus' teachings. But I go more to mystics. I've done a lot of the Meister Eckhart.
Yeah.
I'd call myself more of an optimistic mystic. And then I'm over, you know, I'm obviously learning Islam when I'm over in Africa, and respecting how at any time they just lay a mat down and pray through the day, how it's a part of the daily language. It's not like a separate thing that you go on a Wednesday night or a Sunday morning. It's a daily ritual. And so picked up some things about that, about through the day, how you can pray through the day, whether it's meditation or what have you. You know, at the monastery, they're out there in the desert. Part of their view is, look, we're in the desert. And when our mind wanders, we bend a knee and look right at our feet, the dirt, a rock, whatever, and go, that's of God.
Yeah.
That's everything around us is of God. So that's where they pray because they're surrounded by it. I'm more of a mix and you know, different things. And I've gone to Thailand with a Buddhist as well. So I'm trying to take in what I can.
Well, I like in the book that like there was a point where, you know, you kind of hit the wall with the movies that were kind of, you're making you a lot of money. You know, yep. I was telling my friend, it was funny. I was talking to my friend, Sam Lipsight, who's a writer in New York. He's a novelist. I said, I'm reading this Matthew McConaughey book and it's sort of like this hero's journey. And I said, like, you know, I'm right at this part where he just decides he's not going to do rom-coms anymore. And he says, yeah, there comes a point in the hero's journey where they have to say no to rom-coms.
Yeah. I didn't know. It was across the board. Huh? Everyone has to do it at some point. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like I wrote in the book, they're Saturdays.
Yeah,
they're Saturday characters. They're fun. They're ease. They're flip-flops. They're shorts. It's sunny. They're built to be buoyant, to bounce from cloud to cloud.
But you can
There's
do
a
it.
Great value in
and
that.
you had a skill for it.
Yeah, and it's about the jive. Yeah. And it's about the vibe, and you get the right male and female leads and those co-stars that I've been in, and that's it. Look, I mean the rom com. It's not about what my vocation is. You know, how lose a guy? I'm in an advertising agency. Who cares? Mm. It's just about the guy and the girl. They're going to get together. they're going to break up somehow. They're going to get mad. And then the boy will chase the girl at the end. And then we're going to roll credits. We're all going to go, hey, but didn't that feel good? Wasn't that fun? That's the same story over and over and over. We just, people just want to sometimes go, I want to escape and not have to.
So you're only working your charm muscle.
No, it's working more than the charm muscle, because they wouldn't have been, I don't think they would have been as successful if it's only working a charm muscle. Again, one of the things I did in the romantic comedies I tried to do is try to not, you know, a lot of times the male is so emasculated in those, meaning they come back at the end and just like, woe be me, please take me back. Right. I am nothing without you.
Right, right.
And I always tried to give at least some dignity to that and go, look, I screwed up.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I really want you back. And if you forgive me, I think we could really do something great together. But I can't just walk in here and just go, Bob, if you don't take me back, I'm a nothing. I would have these conversations with the directors. I was going like, that guy that you're talking about that comes back and just goes, whatever, just take me back. Right. I'm nothing without you. What girl wants that guy?
Yeah.
Well, it's a load to put on. I'm going like, that girl's walking away going, oh, geez.
Yeah.
You know, stand up for yourself a little bit. So I was doing those, having a great time doing them. But as I said in the book, I felt like I wanted to challenge myself in a different way. I felt like, okay, this is easy. I got the script today. I can do this tomorrow morning. That was fun and easy. But I was like, I want something that I go, I can't do this tomorrow.
You turned down a lot of money. You had a wife at that point. You had a kid, you know, right? And, you know.
And that helped me. I mean, look, I called my money manager when I said, I don't want to do rom-coms anymore. I called my money manager. How did I save my money? Because you save your money well. I said, because I'm about to take off from the work that's been coming my way. I called my agent. He says, great. I said, really? I'm bringing in a nice 10% with these rom-coms to your company. You sure it's just great? Jim Toth of Mensch says, I don't work for them. I work for you. Great. Boom. Then I go to Camilla. Her and I have been talking about it. I'd shed tears over trying to figure out what it was I wanted could do in my career and what I wanted to do. And about making this full stop about, as I said, what I wanted to do was not coming my way. So,
which were meatier parts, more interesting, deeper characters, drama.
Dramas, right? So they weren't coming my way. So if I couldn't get what I wanted, I had said my decision was, well, stop doing what it is you don't want to do. Process of elimination. So I said no to the rom-coms. And it took Hollywood quite a while to say, okay, we get the message. And then there was just nothing that came in. Mind you, I had nothing came in.
You were taking a risk and you said no more rom-coms and there was nothing. You weren't getting nothing.
Nah,
so were those nights with your wife where you're like, what the fuck am I going to do, man? What did I do?
Hell yeah, there was. Yeah, there was, man. There were some wobbly nights for sure, man. I'm like going, what have I done? And then my family's going, what are you doing, man? You turned down that money? God damn, buddy. You're going to go, what do you just go nail it? Hammer it. Get out of it. I'm like, no. But then, and they understood, but they were like, geez, man, sure you're taking this too seriously. I'm like, no, it's what I got to do. And my wife said to me very early on when we agreed to take the sabbatical, she said, all right, if we're going to do this, we're doing it all the way. And we're not going to half-ass it. She repeated my dad's words to me. And so 20 months later, after nothing, is when I think Killer Joe was the first thing that came in. And then those dramas that I wanted started coming my way. And all of a sudden, I was like, whoa.
Killer Joe with Friedkin?
Yeah.
That Tracy Letts play. He's a great guy, Tracy.
Yep.
And so is Bill.
Yep.
Friedkin's a trip, right?
Yeah, isn't he? I mean, he's over there. What's he doing? Orchestrating some symphony in Czechoslovakia today?
Talk about stories, dude. Oh, my God. Right? I talked to him for like 2.5 hours, and it all came together. It was crazy.
Absolutely. Dude, he does, you know what he does? One take. Tells everybody right off the bat, you get one take. He's like, that's shoot, you get one take, that's it. And everyone goes, oh shit, one take. But what happens when you only know you only have one take is you just don't hold anything back on take one and you just go, fuck it. Let's let it rip. It's actually a great exercise that you can't as an actor rely on, oh, well, I'll fix it or I'll do something different. No, you got one. Here you go. It's live. Let it down.
So you were able, so that was your kind of re-entry into acting.
It was that.
Movies.
It was Paperboy. It was Mike. It was Mud.
When was Tropic Thunder? Because that's a great one, man.
Tropic Thunder was
before
that. So I think, yeah, the re-entry for me, I think, was Lincoln Lawyer.
A few years.
Killer
right.
Joe-ish.
Did you have fun on Tropic Thunder?
Oh, shit, yeah. We shot that in Kauai. That was so much fun. You could tell that was something when we were doing it.
I think it was a genius movie. I think it's a genius fucking satire.
And so fun to watch over and over and over. There's not a dead. There's no dead weight in the movie. The whole thing is a romp and a ride and originally funny.
When he's
so good.
When he's having the crisis of identity and you know with the wooden statue and like with the little the kid made him an Oscar and he's putting that guy's teeth in to do the oh my god,
so good.
It's dark, yeah. Man. So okay, yeah. So Killer Joe gets you back in. Mud gets you some recognition.
So what did I do in that 2 years, that 20 months? I didn't rebrand, I unbranded. Meaning I was not on the beach getting shot shirtless.
Yeah.
I was not doing rom-com. So your proverbial seat where you were like, where's McConaughey in the world? It got to a point where nobody knew where I was. It was like, I don't know where he is.
I think he's in
so
a trailer.
I became a new good idea.
Oh, interesting.
So I was away long enough that I became a new,
yeah.
Hey, you know what'd be an interesting idea? Where 2 years before that would not have been an interesting idea.
Yeah.
All right. So these movies start coming my way. Those Magic Mike, Paperboy. You know, I had control of Dallas Buyers Club, but nobody wanted to make it with me. But I started, you know, I made a few movies that were critically successful and made some bank. They were original characters. And all of a sudden, somebody who might be able to get Dallas Buyers Club financed. Still, no one wanted to finance a 1980s period age drama.
But what do you mean? You were attached to it for years.
Yeah, and I was attached to it.
Wait, how did that happen? How did you, like, you know, what was the problem?
That came to me. I read it, loved it, and said, all right, there's something here. This is an unsentimental way to tell this story. I want this. So I attached myself to it. Now that's just that means, all right, McConaughey's attached. We can go out to look for directors. There were plenty of times that other people tried to come swipe it from me. And I was like, to my agents, do not let that one go. That I believe will see its day with me and it's somewhere down the line. Huh. And thankfully it did.
It's interesting how it came together. But what I found like in the reading the book that, you know, you got to know, what was his name? Woodson? What's the character's name?
Ron Woodruff,
like that. You got to know his daughter and his mother, sister. His sister, and yeah. They gave you his diary.
Give me the diary. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were really able to kind of like, I imagine the depth of that, and you're working with Penny, right?
Yeah. I'm working with Penny.
And you had all that information.
Now I'm seeing the guy from the inside out.
Right.
Now I'm seeing the guy that's not written about in the script. I'm seeing the guy before he got HIV.
Right.
All right. So now I've got this whole story and it's in his words. And I saw this sort of this dreamer. Like I said, this guy who, you know, really he'd have these doodles, you know, you could tell when he was getting high or whatever.
Right.
And he'd doodle in his diary. And then he'd write things about like, I'm going to go tomorrow morning, you know, 7 a.m. I'm going to install these speakers for the Johnsons over across town. You know, I've got the speakers. I got to go get some monster cable. And he did real tiny writing and add it all up to the penny. That means I'll have like $6.42 worth of gas.
Yeah.
That'll get me back. And then he'd get up on his second cup of coffee, iron in his shirt before he goes to work. And his pager would go off and it'd be like, oh, sorry, Ron, we don't need that. We're going with somebody else who can insure themselves. Boom. Now what's he do? Well, now his days, his ambition for the day was kind of gone. So now he's going to head over to Sonic and see old Nancy Blankenship and maybe go shag up a little bit and get him a double cheeseburger and call it a day. And Friday night's coming early.
Right. So it's just like mundane details of this guy who, you know, becomes this kind of like the arc and the hero of this tale. Like you were able to humanize him to a depth that's not usually available because you had his own words, you know.
Yeah. Well, it also allowed me not to go in and play a guy who has HIV. Look, now who's the man before he had HIV? Now play that guy who actually gets HIV.
Yeah.
He also, you know, he saw how extravagant he would dress up for Halloween and stuff. And he loved jazz and he liked to go up to the Northeast. And he was kind of a carny performer,
huh.
You know. And his family told him about things he would invent. But he wouldn't get the patent on.
Huh.
Like he didn't quite follow through. He'd invent, and then all of a sudden they go get the patent. He'd go like, no, no, no. And then 2 years later, someone would get the patent on his idea and steal it from him. And he's like, he never quite followed through
right.
on certain things. And there was a certain humanity and loneliness to that of a guy who was kind of drifting. That told me a lot. I had the inside track on him.
Yeah, it was such a great character, great movie, great job. You know, and it's like one of those, it's nice. Like, it was one of those years where, you know, you win Best Actor and you're like, hey, he deserved it. You know what I mean?
Oh, cool.
You know
cool.
what I mean? Yeah. It wasn't cool. like, how the Thank fuck you. Did that? You know?
Right. 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 Yeah. Yeah.
And you were pretty
Thank you.
Lit up that night. You went with your
mom. Oh, yeah, man.
You went with your mom, right?
With my mom and Camilla,
yeah.
my wife.
Yeah.
That was, yeah, that was a real special. I remember, you know, I was getting pretty numb. As the category came up and the whole room kind of went like, and I remember just looking at the names and going, no one else's name starts with an M. So if you hear a M, that means it's you. And I remember laying my head back and I heard M, and I was like, I'm not sure. And then I look around me, my mom stands up, my friend Kevin Moore stands up, Camilla stands up there, start clapping. I'm like, started with a M, Matthew, they called my name.
It's interesting that, you know, something that you put that much work into and that was that personal for you and that you championed the thing all the way through. Were you a producer on it or no?
No,
but it
I
was.
Think so.
But your collaboration with the director was kind of tight, right? You guys really.
Yeah, like we were Jean-Marc Vallée, who's now gone on to direct so many more things. And, you know, he had done a film called Crazy, which when I saw that film called Crazy, I don't know if you've ever seen it. Y'all check it out. It's wild. It's fun and really well told. And again, I write the book. I don't know how he got the money to get that soundtrack. That guy gets music, and I don't know how he gets the music for the budgets he has. Anyway, he was the right guy for it.
And what was it like? Because I have to also assume that, you know, given, I mean, the fucking vulnerabilities of, I've been watching a lot of old movies in quarantine and really kind of noticing, you know, what really makes a scene or a performance work is the vulnerability, you know?
Let's open up that word, because I've had not the best relationship with that word through my life of what that means.
Okay,
I'm with you, and I'm more evolved, and I like the word now and understand it.
Well, like an example that that I was heading towards. Well, I mean, I think that, like, it seems to me that vulnerability to you would somehow be somewhere in the area of weakness.
It used to be
right.
Yeah,
but I imagine it's primarily because you didn't recognize it and your definition was tied
to right. I think that's correct.
Yeah. Like for me, like, you know, the ability for you to engage in the character that, you know, was being humiliated by this disease and also find strength with it. And also, you know, have to reckon with the judgment reserved for people that he wasn't, you know, that he could not get away from. And then develop a relationship with Jared Leto's character.
Yep.
That you surrendered to. I mean, that's as vulnerable as you can get on screen, really.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I
mean, it's just it human. Was, I mean, it's just,
yeah, it's superhuman. I mean, what was always in my pocket was in my pocket as Ron Woodruff as an actor was, it's got to do whatever it takes to stay alive. That's like the ultimate, talk about the ultimate obstacle to overcome. I mean, that's like the baseline. What's your job? I'm trying to stay alive. And you know what? The other thing I'm going to blame, I'm not, when I said earlier, the unsentimentality of that film dealing with that subject matter, Ron was a businessman. He was trying to make money.
Right.
So that sort of undercut, he was never the guy who waved the white flag for the cause.
No, I get that. But when his humanity got so stripped down,
yep.
He couldn't help but feel empathetically with the humanity of somebody else.
100%. 100%.
So that, you know, that's a vulnerability that's earned despite the character's intentions.
Right. Right. Yep.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, I think the word to me means that, you know, whether you mean to or not in the character or whether the character means to or not, where, you know, the human heart is exposed, you know, so everybody can feel it. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And that, I mean, look, I gotta say this, man, a script written well.
Yeah.
A character that goes through real things like that. Those are you listed a few, the relationship with Leto's character, you know, a world that's ostracizing him. I mean, those are great obstacles to overcome and engage it. If those scenarios are not there, those are dynamic. That's not, we talk about rom-coms floating across a cloud. That's not rom-com stuff. That's like the basement. That's what's great about dramas.
the basement of your lowest base levels of pain and rage and everything, it's as low as an actor as you want to go. It's up to me. It's up to me and that character. I can go as far deep as I want to go. Now, the extent, the ceiling of joy, of life, the vitality is as high as I want it to be. No, in rom-coms, you're compressed. The ceiling can't be too high. Sure, the base can't be too low. Right. You'll sink the ship if you go too low.
Right.
You get a good drama. It's like, it's up to you. The ceiling's, there's no roof and there's no basement. You go, tell me how you feel, how, what, come show me your rage.
Right.
Show me your ecstasy.
Right. And you don't have to analyze it, you know, what that means. You know, it's just, you know, you can feel the character. Well, it's interesting that,
the character.
That your relationship with the idea of vulnerability, because like, that's another thing that I was noticing in the book that, you know, you definitely, you know, keep some shit to yourself and, you know, and, and some of it is emotional shit. And, you know, you kind of give short shrift to certain things where you like, even, you know, whatever that journey was through that 20 months, you must have been, you know, just a pain in the ass and a wreck and a panic in some ways. Right. But you
at times right. I sure was.
And then like, there's this other thing where we had to go back to Texas for personal reasons. So there's obviously struggles and real shit that, you know, you're like, I'm going to keep this to me because I got to, you know, I got to own that. That's my own heart.
And here's why. Let's bring up the family deal. That's just, if I bring up what it was that I came back for, the family deal, the family crisis, if I go into details of that, I'm not interested in opening up my profile into my, and so now people want to ask that, and that's not the profile on me and my something happened in my family. That's a different book. That's why bedrooms have doors on them, bro.
I'm not you.
You know what I mean? I'm saying there's certain things where it's like, no, you know what? I'll leave that obtuse.
But see, for me, you know, seeing you now and talking to you now, I'm like, I wonder how he handled that shit. You know what I mean?
Well,
whatever the fuck it was. Because, like, you know, I know how you handle, you know, like your decision to go to Africa because you came in your bed, you know, but like, you know, life handed up some shit, you know, like, how do you deal with that shit?
Oh yes. There were nightmares amongst the wet dreams.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah. But I get that's a different book, but I think that's also has, like, I don't know that you'll ever write that book, and it has something to do with your aversion to the idea of vulnerability.
Look, we got 24 hours in a day. You and I sit here and talk. We got an hour, hour and a half. I'm one for, you know, I still have a little bit of that survival mechanism. Yeah. I don't want to hear all of your big problems either. I like to hear how you overcome and go through them, but I'm going to go, look, that part happened. It's not constructive to the story of how I got out of it. I'm a little bit of that day. If you ain't got something good to say, don't say it at all. There's plenty of times I don't say I'm doing stuff and saying stuff that's not
right. Of course.
You know,
yeah.
The most constructive. Like I said, I step in plenty of shit myself. But I don't want to open that up to someone's armchair psychoanalysis of you. Well, so you went through with your family and they were going through that. Yeah. There's another situation. So did you, I talk about non-deserving complexes, times of feeling insignificant and all those things, but that's my family business.
I get the family business.
In the same way, I don't talk, it's not a tell-all book.
No, I get it.
I don't go in and tell you things about people I worked with that are negative to the end or make you go, oh, that's juicy. You know, I'm like, that's nobody else's business. That's just decency. I believe it's just decent, being decent.
Sure. And it's also protecting the people you love on another level.
Sure.
Right.
Yep.
But so I like the list at the end. It's nice, you know, that like, and I,
how about that?
I believe you.
How about that?
I believe that that's a list that you wrote when you were
1992 or three.
10 goals in life. Become a father, find and keep the woman for me, keep my relationship with God, chase my best self, be an egotistical utilitarian.
Utilitarian.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the system in the book.
It is.
Take more risks, stay close to mom and family, win an Oscar for best actor, look back and enjoy the view, just keep living. So that's nice when you... Because, like, I know that about myself. Like, and you didn't know this list was around until you started going through the shit to write the book?
I forgot where I put that list the day after I wrote it.
Right. Like, there's things in my mind where I'm like, I want to manifest that, but I don't want to talk about it too much. And I just know I'm write it down on a note. And then years later, you're like, okay, I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
Right.
Right.
Where subconsciously, if what we write down is true, it's in our lineage.
Yeah.
And it's the things that I notice that I'll write down. I go, I'm chasing it. If I'm playing grab ass with my thoughts or grab ass with my memories, trying to chase it back down, I'm like, oh, well, you didn't quite mean it. I say this book. I write everything down so I can forget it. You know what I mean? I write it down because I go, oh, I don't want to forget that. So I'm going to write it down so I can.
Right.
It'll be there.
I definitely relate to that. So how's your level of loathing these days?
I'm happy to say it's pretty low.
That's good.
I'm more loathing for can we get through this year? Can we get through COVID? Can we get through the Cultural Revolution? Can we get through the election?
Yeah.
Without having a civil war.
I don't know.
Can we constructively turn a page here? When is that balance? When can that proverbial hand on the clock that was maybe oppressed to the four, when can it, if six is justice and right now it's swung over to eight and bypassed straight up, when can it level out and we can go, okay.
Right. Yeah.
Where are we going?
Right.
Where are we going? Right. It's about us. Where are we going? And for me, I'd like to meet you in the middle. Man, I'd like to meet you in the table like this and go, let's talk about it. Let's have some conversations without condemnations. Let's see how this COVID time with this invisible enemy we had, how can we, what are the positives? What are the assets this time? Well, I've been forced to do more inventory. I've been spending more time with my kids. I've been doing more cooking with my kids. My kids are taking up on their creative hobbies more than they were before. I've been petting my dogs longer.
Yeah.
There are some assets to it. So, where do we get it? What's the way we're going to work? Are we doing this? Is this the way you and I talk for the rest of our life?
I hope not.
Maybe.
Ugh. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Maybe. And it's got its assets too, because there's a lot of people that I talk with on Zoom.
Yeah.
That I'm like, I prefer this.
Yeah. It's easier.
You know? So my loathing is more about, and look, I'm in no place. I'm not in a place to that. I've got my own stress going on to keep our ship afloat here, keep our head above water as a family, which is my first priority. But I'm more, I'm in a privileged position. My pantry's full.
Yeah.
I don't have to work today to pay my rent tomorrow. So I'm in a privileged position that a lot of people are not. My loathing is more for those people that cannot. And what are we going to do as humanity
on behalf of
to turn
them.
The page
right.
out of this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's really hard to say, man. It's a lot to carry every day, because depending on, I'd rather have your brain than mine in times like this, in the sense that it's hard not to get, weighted down with the darkness of it.
It is, but I think we got to believe, man.
Yeah.
I mean, what's our alternative? We got to believe that there's a light out of this where we're going to evolve. We have to. If not, if we don't believe that and it is the end of the world, well then, fuck it. We might as well believe we can get out of it anyway.
Or just
have a fighting chance.
The end of the country. Ireland's nice. You spent time in Ireland. Could you live in Ireland?
Singapore's nice. I mean, right now, I think more than ever, it's a time where it's like, where do you want to live on the planet Earth? And I'm even thinking about, for the first time in my life, was it all restrained to Earth only?
Oh, right. Yeah.
When, you know what I mean? Where, you know.
When's Branson getting the rocket done? I'm ready.
You know what I mean? But where on the planet? Would you really like to live?
Yeah.
For you and your family, your kids, and you're with, this is an example, these discussions like this remote living, that you can kind of live wherever the hell you want and be wherever
you
want.
That's the weird thing. It's like, yeah, it is a privileged place to be, to make those kind of decisions, be able to make those kind of decisions, but to realize, but we gotta, I guess, it's like hope for the best is one thing, but obviously something has shifted kind of permanently, and there is an adaptation to make, whether or not we fall on, on the side of sustaining life on the planet or we don't. It's tough. It's a tough call right now, but we'll see.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we will see. We will see. And I hope, that we don't, it's so easy right now, you got the perfect Bermuda Triangle, you've got unemployment, you got this invisible murderer called COVID who is also in our psyche because, you know, Americans, we want to meet the enemy at the gate. This is one of those ones that says, yeah, that's where I want him. I want you to meet me. Come on out.
Sure.
So you can take it back into your home. So,
or you can choose to deny it. Yeah, we've got,
or deny it even exists.
We've got the Bermuda Triangle of, you know, of COVID, you know, of environmental problems and a tremendous kind of chaotic lack of leadership that's making it's exacerbated. It's crazy town.
And so what do we do? And this is why part of the reason we're getting even more extreme right now. People don't have an identity. They've lost purpose. They're wondering what the fuck's going on in the world. I don't know what the next step is. Yeah. I'm unemployed. Well, I want to cling on to something to feel like my feet are on the ground.
What
are they clinging on to? These tribes that are way over here on the extreme.
How about hate? Let's cling on to hate.
Yeah. I don't know what I want, but I know what I don't want. Yeah. And that's whatever you're selling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I got somebody says the other day, they said, where do you sit politically? I said, man, I'm aggressively centric. Said, I'll meet you in the middle, man. And like, yeah, ain't nothing in the middle of the highway but yellow lines and dead armadillos. And I said, well, let me tell you something, bud. I said, I'm walking down the middle here and the armadillos are running free because the left and the right are so far to the left and the right, their tires ain't even on the fucking pavement. They're in the dirt.
Yeah, I got free road here.
The shoulder.
Yeah. Open road. Well, we'll see what happens, man. But I enjoyed the book. I'm glad we talked, you know.
I am too. I enjoyed it. I was looking forward to talking to you and glad we did.
And I enjoy your work. We didn't talk about True Detective. That was great. And,
thank you. I missed that.
Yeah. It's always good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you. Carry on. If you ever get past Abiquiu, go hop over there. Old brother Christian's the abbot over there.
I will. Maybe I'll see you at Opie sometime.
Deal.
Okay, man.
Sausage and jalapeno corn.
I'm in.
Just keep living.
Thanks, buddy.
Later.
There you go. There's a moment in there, and I'm not going to tell you which one it was, where I think you get a window into what's behind. All right, all right, all right. Now I will play some distorted loud guitar for you. All the cat angels.